Welcome to the Autonicast. I'm Ed Niedermeyer. With me, as always, is Mr. Alex Roy.
Hello, Edward.
Hi, and Kirsten Korosek.
Hey, guys.
So last week, Kirsten was telling us all about her visit to Waymo's Castle facility, test facility in California. And she hinted at the time that it sort of seemed like Waymo might be possibly moving towards a true driverless deployment. You'll never guess what news broke since we recorded that episode, Kirsten.
Hey, I was right. So they pulled the human test driver from behind the wheel. So they are doing that. It is happening right now in Chandler, which is basically a suburb of Phoenix. And the really interesting thing about, there's a lot of really interesting things about this story. It's a huge milestone, obviously. They pretty much leapt ahead of everyone else. I mean, everyone kind of already considered them to be in the lead a little bit. But, you know, other automakers and tech companies I would talk to and startups would push back. But now they really can't because here they are. They're doing this. But a couple of caveats. There's still Waymo or Google employees in these vehicles for now. They're just not behind the wheel.
No.
The general public is not in these cars, these minivans yet. Mm-hmm. But they will be here in the next couple of months. And this is a geofenced area, meaning geographic limitations. But Waymo was pretty clear with me that all the typical things that you would encounter in driving a car, so left-hand turns, which is a difficult thing actually here in Arizona, are happening. So some of the more complex forms of driving are occurring. Huh. There are no limitations on that. And eventually, and this is the crazy part, eventually they're going to expand this to basically most of Phoenix. And to give you a sense of what Phoenix proper is, you know, counting Scottsdale, Tempe, Phoenix, that's like more than 600 square miles. So they compare it to like the greater London area. There's a lot going on there. Obviously, we're going to be watching their progress over the next few months, but a really important milestone in the autonomous driving world for sure.
What's interesting to me is that there's still going to be Waymo employees in the car. They're just not going to be behind the wheel. What is Waymo saying that these folks are there to do?
Well, I think right now they're just testing the transition. I mean, it's a big step to take the test driver from behind the wheel, right? So they're not going to just go from pulling them from behind the wheel to throwing, you know, the general public in there. They're going to do this testing, make sure that nothing happens before they put the public in. And the public that's going to go in there, these are people who are already part of the early rider program, which launched in April. So these are people who are not being pulled off the street. These are folks who are already using this app to order the vehicles. Right now, those people are in vehicles where there is a human test driver behind the wheel, but that is slowly going to change. And soon they will be the only ones in there. So to me, it just is a typical transition. I think it would be weird if they weren't doing it, quite honestly.
Yeah.
It's funny because you have, you know, there was this article a few months ago with Navigant Research published their study about who's ahead in self-driving cars.
Right.
And we all argued about that thing. And last week, there's been this peculiar kind of Twitter battle between, I guess, our friend Ray Wirt, who's the GM storyteller, and keeps putting out these tweets saying, GM is ahead, GM is in the lead. And there's been this fight between the publicists and comms people from different companies over who's really in the lead.
Oh, yeah.
And yet here's Waymo just chugging along doing their thing.
We'll see what happens with GM here because they do have a special event happening at the end of the month. So maybe they're about to do the same thing. So I'm going to wait to see what happens there.
I'm, for one, am shocked to hear that there's been Twitter drama that I wasn't aware of. Clearly, I've been doing a good job of focusing on my project, which Twitter was distracting me from. There's been a lot of whispers from GM that make it sound like they are going to announce something big. But one of the things that I think is really interesting about this Waymo news is maybe it's because of the way they announced it, or maybe it's because my theory is that the media has already written so many headlines to the effect that autonomous cars are here already.
This kind of fell flat.
Yeah. So like most notably when Tesla pushed Autopilot 7 and Autosteer became available, there were so many headlines saying driverless cars are here, autonomous cars are here. And I think that they've blown it. And now that autonomous, like real autonomous cars are actually going to be able to give people rides. I mean, this is the future that we've all been waiting for. Now it's here, but it's like the media has blown it. Am I crazy to think that?
Totally agree.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't disagree on that one. I mean, you know, I was told that the Lisbon Web Summit is actually a really big deal. So, you know, maybe it's just us out of touch Americans over here thinking that it's not real unless, you know, it happens here.
Yeah.
But, or the announcement happens here. But yeah, I mean, there's been so much coverage. I mean, and also CEO John Krafcik, the CEO of Waymo, even mentioned it to me and some other reporters when we were visiting Castle, which is like throwing around all these different terms that have been used very liberally within the press that really causes confusion too. I mean, everything from fully autonomous, autonomous, semi-autonomous, semi-driverless, which was the New York Times one. So the media is causing confusion and also just covering these demo rides and things that are really just like minor pilot programs with the same level of visibility as now Waymo actually pulling the human driver out. So yeah, I was really surprised it didn't get more attention. I guess my test is always like if my neighbors talk about what they read in the newspaper and they know that I cover this and they didn't mention it. But every time there's a Tesla thing, they mention it. So, you know, that's my like, you know, average Joe litmus test, I guess. Like, what do my neighbors talk about? Well, they're not talking about Waymo's driverless car program right now, which I find really interesting.
Yeah.
I'd love to know who was the first car manufacturer to push the narrative of with vague language. Was it Tesla? And then everyone jumped in the back.
I don't know if it was Tesla. I think that it was more that they didn't necessarily correct like bad information or bad descriptors, but I don't remember Tesla ever saying anything like, I mean, they're pretty clear when they talk about what they want to do, which is like this fully self-driving. I mean, they're pretty clear with that language, but I don't see them really correcting when people say like beyond level two or they call it semi-autonomous. I don't know.
They've always said that it's not real autonomy, like autopilot was not real autonomy. But then they've also said, you know, on-ramp to off-ramp with no human input or whatever. And I think the real thing for me, and it's not that Tesla was the most egregious in terms of blurring the line between autonomy and driverless, but they just have such a huge media impact. When Autopilot 7 was pushed and Autosteer became available to the public, I mean, every single headline was, it was a video or a picture of a journalist with their hands off the steering wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And the headline was something to the effect of autonomous cars are here already. So again, I don't think it was necessarily the most egregious example of this necessarily, but it was the one that certainly had the most public impact. And I think that the need to walk some of this back more clearly after the Josh Brown thing, at least for the people who are aware of the situation, it probably caused some cynicism about these kinds of announcements. And it does seem a little bit like the well has been almost poisoned now that Waymo is actually doing what the media has said has been done a bunch of times.
What really sucks is that other manufacturers are going to release things that are level two, level three, and people are going to get confused over what is and what isn't.
Yeah.
And that's going to cause additional deaths.
Yep. Yeah.
So it almost doesn't matter how much tech you've got at all anymore. It's a marketing war and it sucks.
Well, I'm really curious to see how Audi handles that because they have the level three technology coming in. And that has always been a difficult one because I mean, there's a reason why Google/Waymo decided not to go down that road. And they've told this story before, but for maybe our listeners who haven't heard this story. So when Google was Google Self-Driving Project, they originally were going to go the route of slowly phasing up into the levels, going from a driver assistance sort of all the way up to fully self-driving. And they did an experiment. They had basically what you could call maybe an autopilot, like an equivalent of where on highway driving, it takes over, you know, steering, adaptive cruise control, there's sensors all around the car. And they let their employees take these cars. And they were very clear that this is in beta and they videoed them. And they actually showed some of these videos at Castle to us. The first one was like, so this woman was putting on makeup. Another person was like trying to plug in their cell phone, you know, sort of kind of glancing up at the windshield, but not really, you know, and this is going down the freeway. the scariest one, the one that I had never seen before, the employee was fully passed out sleeping. It was going about 55 miles an hour. And they said basically 2 to 3 days later, they discontinued the entire program.
Do you know what time frame that was?
It would be pre-2013. I mean, this was early days, I think. Yeah. They took over Castle in 2013 and were doing more fully self-driving pursuits at that point. So this was pretty early on. But that was the reason why they decided that people were initially apprehensive of the technology and then became very fast adopters of it. And they were concerned about that handoff between, being an autonomous world, driving world, and having to then go to, the humans in control. And the automaker that manages to thread that needle, I think, is going to be successful. But anyone else, that's a lot of liability and risk, I think.
And it's interesting, Continental actually just announced a device that's, sort of a cockpit concept, I guess. It's an actual device that is meant to handle that transition. So clearly the tier ones are looking at that and trying to solve that problem. But I think if, Waymo being as far ahead as they are on so many elements of this problem, the fact that they and Ford and others have decided just to not deal with level three, I agree. It makes Audi and anybody else who goes into level three, there's gonna be a lot of focus on them because those are going to be the situations where, Josh Brown type of crashes are going to be most likely.
What's so insane is that there was such a complete failure of imagination, because of all the manufacturers, why is Toyota the only one developing this Guardian approach? And Toyota is not a driving enthusiast, fun car manufacturer. Not even the Lexus stuff is considered really that fun to drive. And here's Audi, and they make sports cars, and they're doing a traditional level three, series autonomy solution, which is the worst thing in the world for somebody who wants to enjoy driving their car. It just sucks the life out of it. And when Waymo made that decision to go straight to level four, that's an easy and obvious one, because they were never in the car manufacturing business, and a working level four or five solution is the perfect licensable platform. But an augmentation like parallel approach, like Toyota's, that it's coming from Toyota is an indication both of the wisdom of it and the fact that all the driving enthusiast brands have just missed the boat. I'd love to know what the correlation is between R&D on a series approach, three up through four, and whether it's possible, when they see the wisdom of Toyota solution, to backtrack and actually develop parallel systems. Because no manufacturer making a car that is marketed and branded as fun to drive is going to be able to move level three and four solutions without diluting their brand. It's impossible.
Until Toyota actually has something out on the road where we can actually, really sit in the driver's seat and sort of feel what that guardian angel feels like and how it reacts, we don't really know if it's going to be successful. So it sounds like a good idea. I think it's a reflection of the company's culture and also a really good understanding of who its consumers are or who its owners are. I mean, we might, like, a year from now or 2 years from now, we might all be like, well, that was a big mistake. I mean, we don't know until we actually get to test something.
You're totally right, of course, and you're echoing things Ed and I have said, so you're right, and I'm being hypocritical in a way. But there's this article in Slate which was saying that, what's the headline? A dangerous self-driving car is still better than a human driver. We know conceptually from Airbus automation that a guardian type system makes sense, and that a traditional, like a level three system, doesn't really make a lot of sense without training. And since drivers are not trained, a parallel approach conceptually is superior. And I could beat this horse, forever. But I have a feeling there's going to be a real bloodbath in the future among enthusiast car brands. Mercedes has AMG and everything else. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you market autonomy in an AMG? You don't. I mean, you can for people who just don't care about driving. It just doesn't make any sense at all. I think that there's got to be something coming from Porsche in the future, who've been completely silent on this, if not negative on autonomy altogether, that's going to be like the Guardian system. And if not, they're going to have a problem too.
Yeah, I think that the problem with the Guardian approach, I think it's a fantastic concept in terms of, like, you know, improving the safety, right? It's a very pragmatic way to try and improve safety right now. But I think the problem that it's faces and will continue to face is a marketing problem. Look at what's been successful. What's been successful is autopilot, which has created the impression of autonomy when in fact it isn't really autonomous. And that doesn't improve safety. It's actually worse for safety. And yet it's been insanely popular. Like, taking a less safe approach has actually been really effective way to market Teslas. My concern about all of these semi-autonomous or what have you systems is that, you know, the market incentive, yeah, the safety incentives exist to you know, augment driver skill as much as possible. But the market incentives, I think, are the opposite. I think they are to make the system seem more autonomous than they are, because people, it's a trend and people think autonomy is cool and people want to own a car that they drive themselves.
The Toyota Camry owner is very different from the Tesla Model S owner. I mean, and this is going to be a stereotype, but I mean, I think if we can speak in generalities just for a moment, acknowledging, of course, that everyone's different and they have their own special views. And maybe there is someone who's a Toyota Camry owner who wants nothing more than autopilot. But in general, Tesla's success has come from early adopters. In the very beginning, these were people, this was their third car. And these are people who embrace technology and are willing to use it very early on and be part of the experiment. That was the draw and has been the draw to that company. To say that everyone else, every other consumer wants the same thing or is comfortable with that kind of risk, I think that's not very accurate. So it's very hard. I think a lot of automakers have found this. It's like, it's very hard to become a Tesla because the magic that Tesla creates with its fan base is sort of being part of something that is new and fresh. And it's like, it's hard for an established automaker to do that, I think. It's really hard.
Especially when they've been sued for something like sudden intended acceleration.
Right.
I mean, I think that is a massive scar on Toyota's psyche that absolutely prevents them from trying to be on the cutting edge the way Tesla is.
And the sheer volume, of cars. I mean, right. the void between the number of cars that Tesla produces and delivers and a company like Toyota is just massive. So it's really hard to compare. I do think that the guardian angel approach really fits the Toyota brand. I mean, it makes total sense. I would never imagine them doing something like a rollout, like how Tesla rolled out autopilot. It would be a head scratcher. And then the other hard thing with, like, Alex's point is that because of the cost of sensors and all the tech that goes into it, the most, like, logical place where we're going to see these first is in high-end luxury automobiles and our vehicles. And a lot of them are sports cars. And then that's where this weird sort of push and pull starts occurring, where it's like, well, I just want a really awesome, fun car to drive, but why do I want it to take over the driving for me? But because it's an expensive car, I'm going to have all the bells and whistles in it. And that's, I think, I don't know how you get around that.
So you remember back when we interviewed former NTSB chairman Christopher Hart, he had in his article an interesting point, which is that airlines airlines and plane manufacturers, they don't go after each other and make claims about improved safety. And at this point, statistically, airline crashes, even between manufacturers, they're very low, and the differences are very low. I would be shocked if in the future, some autonomous vehicle manufacturers, in order to differentiate themselves, if they don't start going after each other over crash incident rates and real safety figures. Because if I was Guardian Toyota, and I was deploying Guardian and Chauffeur, my overall accident rates and fatality rates were dramatically lower than another manufacturer's, you better believe I'm going to use that in my advertising.
Yeah.
You have to. And I think for the first time, we're going to see manufacturers go after each other in a real way and make some real claims. And then they're going to have to back that up.
Yeah.
Speaking of accidents and crashes, since that's been sort of like the implication here underlying this whole thing, I mean, there was one sort of big, it actually got, I think, more attention possibly than Waymo pulling human drivers out of the car, was this shuttle crash in Las Vegas.
So this was a low-speed shuttle that was, it's by a company that's not super well-known. Is it Navya? Is that how it's pronounced? It's a French company?
Yeah, I think that's how you pronounce it. I'm sure we'll be corrected by it. So
yeah,
we'll stick to that pronunciation for now, and then hope for the correction.
Yeah. So just to fill in, this is an oval shuttle. It fits 8 people, and it does have an attendant and computer monitor, but no steering wheel or brake pedals.
Well, by the way, which is gonna very important in this story.
Yeah, exactly. It uses GPS, electronic curb sensors, and other technology to find its way at no more than 15 miles per hour. And this is from a Guardian story about this.
So this is a low-speed shuttle. And, you know, it's funny because I was invited to go to this, but did not. So I wish I had been on hand for that. But I think that this, I mean, I'll let you guys get into the what happened. But as a preface, I do think that this is going to be the most common driverless sort of technology we're going to see deployed first, like low speed shuttles that bring people through highly congested traffic areas. Would you agree?
Or yeah.
I mean,
okay. Geofence, low speed shuttles, I think.
Right. So at universities, corporate campuses, down really major, busy major streets like the Strip, let's say in Las Vegas, would make a lot of sense. If anyone's ever driven there, they know what a nightmare that is. Things like that. So that's why I was interested in the story. Who wants to talk about what happened?
I'd love to talk about it.
Okay.
To the extent that we know, so the shuttle was advancing down the street, and there was an 18-wheeler truck backing into an alley parallel with the shuttle's, line of travel, direction of travel. The shuttle stopped, and the truck kept backing up and ended up grazing the front of the shuttle, which was stopped. And apparently, the shuttle honked at the truck, and nothing happened. And it seems very obvious that if a human was driving the shuttle, it would have backed up.
Right.
Or
if it was what we think it is, which was a very slow, the way it's been described, I'm like imagining this truck like slowly dropping up, backing up with like, little sound usually that happens when a big truck is backing up. And then the people in this shuttle like watching it come towards them and then nothing happening and then all of a sudden being hit. But do we know how fast the truck was backing up?
So slowly, according to a passenger on the shuttle, that people pulled out their phones and took pictures of the truck as it was backing up.
Okay.
By the eyewitness accounts, it seems like it was extremely slow. And what's interesting is that, so this shuttle, it's a cooperative effort between obviously Navya, the French company that makes and designed it, but also the American Automobile Association of, I think, California and Nevada and Utah or something like that. And AAA's involvement sponsoring it is supposed to be highlighting the fact that 90% of all car crashes are a result of human error. And the city of Las Vegas made a statement about this incident that I think is really interesting. And I'll just read it real quick. The autonomous shuttle was testing today when it was grazed by a delivery truck downtown. The shuttle did what it is supposed to do in that its sensors registered the truck and the shuttle stopped to avoid the accident. Unfortunately, the delivery truck did not stop and graze the front fender of the shuttle. Had the truck had the same sensing equipment that the shuttle has, the accident would have been avoided. Testing of the shuttle will continue during the 12-month pilot in the Downtown Innovation District. And I think this is just something that we are starting to see more of, and I think we'll see a lot more of, which is that everyone kind of knows and accepts that like humans are imperfect drivers and that human error is responsible for most crashes. And there's this sort of desire to present autonomous cars as the opposite of that, and that they can never be at fault. Part of it is that we understand crashes in very simplistic terms. It's one person's fault or it's the other person's fault. So in this case, yeah, they can say, had the truck had the same sensor equipment, it would not have hit the shuttle. However, if a human had been behind the wheel of the shuttle, as Alex mentioned earlier, right, they would have just backed out of the way. There was plenty of time. It's certainly not as simple as it was one party's fault and absolutely not the other. These things are always more complex than that.
I bet you Navya wishes there was a steering wheel in that shuttle right now.
Yeah, I mean, it should not have been hard for someone to, switch it into into manual mode and back up 10 feet.
Do we have reports though? I mean, just to like give them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt since none of us were there, do we know if there was an obstruction behind them or anything like that? Like the reports of people within the shuttle, do we have any information about what's behind?
Well, based on the pictures, it looks like it was clear behind. In fact, this eyewitness account at Digital Trends, this guy says, and I read the exact sentence, that his suggestion to Navia is that if the shuttle doesn't have cameras and LiDAR facing backwards, it would be good to allow enable the shuttle to reverse if something's coming towards it. So rear facing, what is the rear facing sensor set? Like, how could you deploy a vehicle, a driverless vehicle, without 360 sensor coverage? It seems like insanity.
We should check into that, because that would be, I mean, I would expect them to have 360.
Yeah.
Well, even if they had the sensors, though, I mean, it just didn't back up. That's right. I mean, right. That part cannot be denied, that it could have, that eyewitnesses say that there was an opportunity to. And by the way, I mean, my personal hot take on this is that it's another example of this race to autonomy, race to the perception of autonomy, you know, means that people are putting systems out there that are not fully capable of dealing with all the circumstances they might find. And as bizarre as it would seem that someone would put this Navia, you know, bus without the ability to back up, there are other examples in the sense that, you know, Tesla, it says that it automatically will change lanes for you. Well, it doesn't have rear-facing radar, and so that's not safe either. You have to check your blind spot. And there was a big debate between Berlin and some other folks about whether that means it's automatic or not. What I'm saying is that, you know, this is not the first time that systems have been deployed without being really capable of all the things that they should be.
Right. Did you guys ever read the book by, I guess, Abbott called Flatland?
No.
So it's a fascinating book. It's about a world that is two-dimensional. And some of the characters are only capable of moving forward, and they have a flashing light on the front. And so one of the characters is actually just like a line, and this universe where everyone's moving around and they're not allowed to back up. And in fact, it is illegal for certain people to back up. And so the notion that a vehicle is driverless, it is not capable not only of 360 degree sensing, but 360 degree behavior and decision-making means it's not really driverless. It's a single vector, like limited arc, you know, moving device. And it's, in fact, that's the standard. Like, that's what the DOT and NHTSA should be talking about, is what is the decision-making capability of a vehicle? Forget actually whether or not there's someone in the car, because having someone in the vehicle doesn't help at all if they can't override it. And so actually there's a great counter argument to Waymo, which is that no matter what happens, there should be a wheel in the car.
For what it's worth, Navia, they do use 360-degree LiDAR. So in theory...
So it's, they have another problem, which is that they just didn't build the functionality.
Yeah. Possibly. And it's hard to say which is worse.
I mean, Mercedes's current E-Class has a rear-facing radar, but it is not, it's not linked to the radar cruise control system. If something's going to impact you from the rear, all the rear-facing radar does is notify the tensioner system to tense the seatbelts and set off the sonic alert, which is supposed to protect your eardrums from the impact. It has no actual bearing on mitigating the crash itself other than post-crash or in-crash.
Yeah.
Right, but that's not, I mean, when you get into that vehicle, you're not expecting it to be fully autonomous or...
That's the same vehicle they marketed as Drive Pilot, you know, self-driving.
Right.
And then had to backtrack on that.
Yeah, they backtracked on that one. Well, I mean, I think that the shuttle crash also points out this, you know, Gil Pratt with the Toyota Research Institute has talked about this a couple of times, basically the intolerance of humans for mistakes by technology, which is to say that if this was like someone in their vehicle who just chose not to back up, but honked the horn and got hit, this would obviously be a non-story. No one would be talking about it, because it was a driverless shuttle on its first day, like in its first 2 hours or something of operation, which makes it, you know, a more dramatic story. But also it raises all these questions where we are now debating, you know, do we trust the technology? What is our tolerance, risk for tolerance? Is it okay that this accident happened? All these discussions that we would never have if it was involving two humans. And so to me, it shows how quickly people who are big cheerleaders or fans of the future and autonomy really have a very, you know, limited appetite for when things go wrong. I could see people pumping the brakes pretty quickly, or a really bad accident on a fully driverless shuttle or vehicle where, you know, people are hurt or are killed, really derailing. I'm going to throw as many sort of transportation puns in the sentence as possible. Really derailing sort of the deployment of, not necessarily the research and development, but the deployment of these types of projects.
Yeah. Well, and I think that the incentives are going to change at some point pretty fast. The incentives have been sort of get your system out there as quickly as you can, you know, create the perception that it's real autonomy, because it's a race to perceptions, right? And I think that sort of we're seeing maybe a transition from that sort of mode to sort of suddenly a situation where the risks of failure could be really, really high, because like we've been saying, you know, the people's tolerance for mistakes by robots is much lower than it is for humans. And I think, you know, part of that comes from the fact that so many people, including the city of Las Vegas in this instance, are not willing to admit that an autonomous vehicle can make sense. And it's understandable that they're doing that, because that they would have legal liability if they acknowledge that this shuttle made a mistake, even though no one was hurt or anything like that. There's still a potential legal liability with them allowing a vehicle to be deployed that maybe wasn't capable of dealing with even a pretty basic challenge. And I think this points out that you know, there's, in addition to automakers competing or you know, tech startups or these companies competing to race to autonomy, also localities, states and cities are racing to become hubs of autonomous vehicle technology. And that also is sort of creating a race to the bottom in terms of what is allowed to be deployed.
Yeah, we talk a lot about who's in the race too, but we really don't talk a lot about the automakers that are like choosing to
not
to just like hang back and watch. I mean, I've had a couple of interesting conversations with some founders of some startups recently, who I'll not name right now, but you know, one at a LiDAR startup and some AI startups. And really their takeaway was like, try and get into it now, you know, and like be really part of the race is just a huge mistake. Like if you're already not at a certain level of capability right now, you're not in the race. So you might as well just chill out, hang back and wait, and then maybe make a choice or decision. Like there's nothing wrong with choosing to be, especially if it fits with your company's culture, and in your consumer culture, to wait it out. Yeah. You know, you don't, because it is sort of a race to the bottom for the people who try to jump in a little late, they make mistakes, you know, maybe they're putting more money towards that R&D program as opposed to making a better, more efficient car, you know, for example. So
Mazda is in a great spot.
Yeah. I mean, why not? Why not? I mean, when we talk about driving experience, and I've asked actually Mercedes, BMW, like Audi, all this question even 2 years ago, how do you navigate that? See, I just can't get away from these puns. How do you navigate through this or balance this idea where you're selling a car that's fun to drive and at the same time pursuing this other purpose, which would essentially have someone driving for you? And the answer I always got was, well, we're going to take over the most boring parts of driving. I'm like, okay, sure. So when you're on an open country road and you can really open it up, then you are handling it. And then when it's, you know, commute to work, then the artificial intelligence and sensors are handling the driving. But I think there is an argument for car companies that just decide not to even pursue this right now and just let their cars be the fun car to drive. And I think Mazda's a classic example of that, like the Miata. Why would you ever put autonomous technology in that car? Like,
I think one of the issues too is that it's been a sprint so far. You know, I think that some of the smarter players realize that it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, and that, you know, the folks that are sprinting right now are much more likely to, you know, have issues like this crash, which then tarnish their reputation to some extent, even if their vehicle wasn't at fault necessarily, even if, you know, no one was hurt. Now, all of a sudden, everyone knows what Navya is, but like not for the right reasons. And so I think if you are looking at this as a marathon, I think you're counting on some of the folks who are trying to sprint for a leading position right now are going to trip and fall and potentially not even be able to finish the race.
Going back, sorry to bring this up, to the Bob Lutz thing from last week, you know, forget what he says about a 20-year timeline for the doom of the auto industry, but he basically says that no one's going to get in a vehicle with any form of branding in the future other than the TNC networks. So manufacturers won't even bother putting anything on the cars. And because they're going to be owned by the networks. So if the networks are opening up with plays like this, then everything we're seeing is self-driving theater, like security theater.
Yeah.
Things are being deployed in the easiest possible places and with the biggest possible headlines to convince everybody that the show is really awesome and you should buy tickets. But the show's not awesome. It actually is fairly lame and no one wants to go twice. I mean, do you think anybody who was on that shuttle is going to get back in a shuttle? Even with the explanation of what went down? No. I almost feel like all the money right now needs to be spent on lobbyists to get DOT to set nomenclature standards that manufacturers can live up to or down to in order to make the product saleable. I think that's everything. Everything.
And I think, like the Josh Brown crash, you know, this is a situation where we need to step outside of it's either the computer or the human's fault. Once again, it's not that simple. It's a complex interaction between the two. And yes, you know, the driver of the truck hit the other vehicle and he was cited for it, apparently. But that doesn't mean this shuttle was blameless either. And the fact that it wasn't able to reverse to get out of the way with plenty of time, I mean, that barely qualifies as a corner case. I mean, that's a pretty basic function.
It's not a corner case at all.
Yeah, that wasn't programmed in. So these incidents, they're going to attract a lot of attention because we have this knee-jerk fear of non-human driven vehicles. But my hope is that rather than just panicking about it, that we're actually able to dig into sort of the complexities of these interactions, and that helps make everyone more aware that this technology is not a simple thing. It's not you just program the computer and then the computer never makes any mistakes. It's dealing with incredibly complex situations where problems will arise out of interactions and misunderstandings as much as they will or more than they will from purely bad programming or even just bad human driving.
Certainly companies are probably internally reviewing, you know, their own policies. But as far as I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think Waymo is the only company so far that has submitted sort of their voluntary safety report, correct?
Yep.
To the federal government, which would kind of go back to Alex's point of like even starting to have those conversations. Am I wrong on that? Is Waymo the only one so far?
As far as I know.
I think they are, yeah.
So it's like, there's all this discussion possibly, I'm sure, certainly internally of all these companies, but I'm not seeing anything happening to push forward Alex's point, which is like creating this standard. In the meantime, then you've got like this RAND Corporation report that came out, which is really pushing a little bit based on research, sort of a different message, which is really like the positive message of it, right? Which is basically that autonomous vehicles should only have to be moderately better than human drivers before being widely used in the US and could save thousands of lives. And I think their research showed that allowing wide use of autonomous vehicles when they are just 10% better than current, just 10% better than current American drivers, think about that, could prevent thousands of road fatalities over the next 15 years. So that's really small percentage gain. And it's a very different messaging that's happening there. I mean, I don't know if you guys have dug into this study at all, but it's pretty interesting. And I'm way more all about what we just talked about. Let's put out pretty good technology now, and we're going to reduce the number of fatalities as opposed to let's take us a little bit of a slower path and wait till the technology is 75, 90% better before it's deployed.
Well, speaking of which, if I were Tesla, for example, and I was having issues with my autonomous technology, I would absolutely wait for a standard to come out, a safety standard, wait until someone else had gone out and had a catastrophic accident, and then the next day announce our system is ready and it's 25% safer than those other idiots whose bus went off a cliff, you know, full of nuns.
You can have something that is statistically safer than a human driver, but maybe it just hasn't come across a specific type of driver behavior or traffic behavior that maybe, you know, mostly exists in certain geographic areas. And so statistically, it looks like it's great, but it's never encountered this corner case or not even really a corner case. And, you know, once it starts encountering those, like in this situation, it just wasn't programmed to deal with that specific kind of interaction. These are collections of individual encounters.
There's a guy on LinkedIn who works for a company called Nexiad. Have you heard of him, either of you?
No.
This guy has published something, I got to find it, about how there's no real good research about how many accidents the average person avoids in a day. and that some people avoid a lot more accidents than others because they put themselves in situations where they may are more likely to occur. Now, think about that in the context of the Mobileye argument that we were talking about with Jim last week, about how if you follow the Mobileye logic, the NRA logic, that if a device works perfectly and that definition is limited, then it cannot possibly be at fault. So by that standard, if India, the country of India, accepted the Mobileye definition of autonomous liability, then no autonomous car would ever be at fault, ever. Yet the number of accidents would be absolutely astronomical.
Yeah.
Because the car is not behaving like people, and the gap between the machine behavior and the, you know, shared human and the human behavior in the same equal, you know, ecosystem is so vast, accidents are going to go up.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to talk about a world in which the majority of vehicles on the road are autonomous. That's a lot easier to control than what's going to happen, which for many years, which is a trickle of autonomous vehicles trying to make their way in a through a world of human drivers. I mean, that is a lot harder to control, certainly.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see a lot more accidents, you know, serious and not serious because of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that both this incident and the Josh Brown case really show that I think Mobileye's approach to this just
sucks.
Yeah. Well, I think Jim McPherson did a great job of explaining why they're doing it. It's because they're essentially negotiating liability. But again, I think that's the factor that we're still not seeing yet play into this, which is that you can be statistically safer, you can be 10 times safer statistically than the average human driver. But if your vehicle kills someone,
it doesn't matter.
Right. It doesn't matter. The legal liability, if you're at fault, or even if purely through a complex interaction with a human driver where maybe nobody was at fault, if someone dies, you will be sued into almost non-existence because that's what we have instead of solid regulation. And I think Alex is right, though, that that's going to be the fear until we have real safety standards, performance-based safety standards for autonomous cars, which I realize we could do a whole episode about the challenges associated with trying to create that kind of standard. But ultimately, unless there's a standard that these companies can comply with, the safety mechanism, the regulatory mechanism is going to be really, really devastating lawsuits.
On the other hand, it's like, and not to say that, you know, we should throw caution to the wind and put everything out there. But to push back against that, I mean, of course, there's the innovator's perspective, which is, well, if we were to wait until federal government and government officials and bureaucracy got their act together and actually came up with a set of standards, we wouldn't have this technology now. So I think that there's maybe a little bit of a balance there. It's so fragmented right now that it's really hard to know, you know, where it's going, where it's headed. Because you don't want to completely put a damper on technological
sure.
innovation. I mean, that's what's so exciting about it. I think it's all about how it's deployed. And right now it's up. We're leaving the decision up to companies to make that choice.
Right. And I have to
interrupt you both because we're coming up in an hour and we have to make a direct appeal to our audience for two things. And the first thing is if you are in possession of a Tesla Model 3, I have a theory based on pretty strong evidence that the battery pack and the is larger than we know, even the 75 watt pack, and that the battery management software is enabling much greater range than Tesla wants made public. We know this because the EPA wanted to rate the car at a greater range than Tesla wanted. So if you're in possession of a Tesla Model 3 and would like to reach out to any of us on the podcast, me obviously and not Ed, because I have more insight and actually care, or Kirsten, who's balanced and actually is, you know, real wisdom, we'd love to learn more about your experience in the Tesla Model 3, and your anonymity is guaranteed. Now, guys, should we talk about what's going to happen at the LA Auto Show?
Yeah, let's do it.
We're all going to the LA Auto Show, and we are going to be conducting interviews and recording podcasts. We're going to be driving around in a Cadillac CT6 with Super Cruise. So we would love to talk to you. If you like this show and you'd like to hear more of the great interviews we've done in the past with people like Jim McPherson and NTSB Chairman Christopher Hart and Gil Pratt, please reach out to us. We will provide an email address. Where are we putting the address, guys?
It'll be in the description of the show, so at autonicast.com.
Right. So reach out to us, and let's get you on the schedule. We're all going to be there for Monday through Thursday. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah. And I would say also, if you're not going to be at the show, but you really want to hear someone's perspective, shoot us a note and we'll hunt those folks down and try to get them, if not at the LA Auto Show, at a later date. But definitely want to hear some feedback on who you want to hear from.
You know, even if you're just a fan of the show and you're not necessarily with a company or someone who we would be looking to interview, drop us a line anyway. And I think it'd be really great to maybe get together with some folks who enjoy the show and get a beer, because we'd love to hear your feedback. We're definitely thinking a lot about how to improve the show.
If for any reason you would like to talk to us in super anonymity, we could even use one of those fun voice boxes from, you know, say Peanuts, like for the parents.
Oh, right.
And conceal your identity.
Nice.
If you want.
Yeah, I'm not sure we have the technological capability to do that. I don't know, Ed. Maybe you can look into that. We can say this, is that I've been sort of working on putting the schedule together a little bit. And so far we've got, I think, a really nice mix of some startup founders and CEOs all the way over to more of the OEM side of things, and really kind of trying to cover sort of all of the themes that fall under that future of transportation or technology and vehicles. So things like safety and cybersecurity, and just sort of talking to some really interesting people and sort of their vision of the future. So I think it'll be really great. So send us your thoughts.
We're really looking forward to it, and we hope, like I said, you'll be part of this experience for us. So with that, Alex, what have you been writing about? What can folks read from you?
Well, my latest article is going to be a deeper analysis of Bob Lutz's op-ed about how the entire auto industry and all auto media are dead, which we talked about a little bit last time. And next up is self-driving theater is the new security theater, of course. And also, there was this big New York Times Magazine self-driving car issue, which had 20 articles in it, mm-hmm. Which was decent. Not like anything really, really new, but worth checking out. So I'll be kind of analyzing that.
Cool. Kirsten, how about you? What are you working on?
Well, I'm on the Daily Beat, so it's like whatever is popping up in the world of cars. But I am going to be, prepping a little bit for the Tesla semi-truck event, which is going to be coming up here later this month, and I will be in attendance at, unless something changes. So certainly starting to refocus back on Tesla again. And then, otherwise really getting ready for the LA Auto Show. So I usually put my articles up on my Twitter feed, which is at Kirsten Korosek. And usually you can find my stuff over at fortune.com as well.
All right. And Alex, of course, is AlexRoy144 on all platforms. For myself, I have a piece at Bloomberg View that went up a couple days ago. It's about the proposed repeal of the tax incentives for EVs. And I actually come out in favor of repealing that incentive. I think it would be good for the EV market and the EV business to at least see if it can stand on its own 2 feet. So if that's something that interests you, you can check that out at Bloomberg View. Otherwise, I'm trying to stay off Twitter, so please don't engage me.
You're doing a terrible job of staying off of Twitter.
I always do, but I need another week or so of minimal distraction. I wish myself the best of luck with that, because it probably won't happen. But yeah, don't talk to me on Twitter. If you see me, tell me to get back to work, so that Kirsten doesn't have to be the only one who does.
Yeah, I feel like I've done that at least a few times.
All right. Well, we'll be back next week. I guess we won't be talking about the Tesla semi next week, but we will have lots of stuff to talk about. There's new stories happening every week, and we just love talking about them. So as we said, please drop us emails or tweet at us if you have suggestions, either for the show or for the LA Auto Show coverage. And until next week, we will see you online.
And hopefully in person in a couple weeks.
Exactly.